Hello and welcome to Wise Women, The Vicar and the Witch. I'm Maggie Whitehouse and I'm the Vicar.
And I'm Susie Crockford and I'm the Witch. We are perceived, perhaps, as being on opposite ends of a spectrum, but we're friends and we see the common threads of our different experience of the sacred. So please join us as we discuss
life, the universe and everything.
Hello, hello, and welcome back. Maggie and I are here on the interweb again, hopefully for your delectation and delight. And this time, we want to carry on last week's conversation and talk more about the spells which humanity are under, or that we perceive that humanity are under. And we were just having a witter before we pressed, whatever it is, we pressed record, so you can tell I'm not the one that does it. And we were talking about enthrallment. And so quickly I fled from Maggie's screen and ran to get the dictionary because I was kind of hoping that enthrallment would have a long entry and mean more than I thought it meant. But it turns out that to be a thrall is to be a servant, enslaved. So enthrallment is enslavement.
It's a spell.
It's a spell.
I was enthralled.
Yeah.
Are you going to remain enthralled? Because if you are, you could be in trouble. If it's temporary, possibly, you know,
Wow.
But and words are such swords.
They are. To me, there's no mistake at all that we call spelling that thing you do when you make words,
yes,
letters in the correct order to make a word.
I never thought of that before.
Have you not? So obvious. Yeah. I just think there's no mistake that that's the same word.
Yes.
And that words have power. You know, in the beginning was the word. Your, yes, you know, Christianity's...
Mine, I wrote that obviously, yes, personally, yes. Oh, I'm very good.
She's much older than she looks, wearing really well. But that also, I discovered, I can't remember what extraordinary adventure I went on via the mystery that is Google, but I ended up discovering that there's an African tribe somewhere, and, you know, even if I knew the name of where they were, I'm afraid my geography is so shameful, I wouldn't be any the wiser. But an ancient mythology, predating Christianity, I believe.
I hope so.
I mean, you know, this is just Google or Wikipedia or something, that says that a people who I think might be near the Dogon tribe have an ancient story about the creation of the world that says in the beginning was the word. And that's how their story begins too.
Yes.
And to me, what kind of so powerful about that is that, you know, one of the statements that you make within shamanic teaching is that words lay the tracks down which the reality train follows. And
absolutely.
So what you say to somebody about their reality, certainly within the context of a healing, you know, what you say happened has so much power. Mm. And so we have to be super careful with our words. But that also, that in my relationship with the spirits, with spirit, with the divine, with the work of the Pythia, so the one who speaks on behalf of nature and on behalf of the spirits, is that I am told over and over again that the word and Gaia herself are the same thing.
Mm, the creative force.
Yeah.
The creative force put into action, because you think something, say it, and then you're probably going to do it.
Mm.
And there's also... I think it's Native American, but I'm sure it's prevalent in all the indigenous things, that if you have something terrible happen to you, you may speak of it only three times.
Mm.
Because if you start speaking of it again and again and again, you become enthralled to it.
Oh, we were straight back round to Carolyn Mace, actually, which is one the reason I adore Carolyn Mace.
Uh-huh.
is I watched, oh my goodness, 25 years ago or something. Then it was a video of her talking about the way that we enspell ourselves through the repeating of our woundology, and that this is the words of someone else entirely, who I'm ashamed to say I can't remember what his name is, but
our biology, our biography becomes our biology.
Oh, Bruce Lipton?
Yes, Bruce Lipton. So, and that, as far as she was concerned, that the first step to healing, when you've had a long illness and you've, you know, you're always telling people, repeating and repeating, that this is what happened and this is how I am, you are enspelling yourself.
Yes, to continue it.
Yeah. And that the first thing that happens is you need to stop speaking about it.
And then people will go, but it's real. I'm saying, real is just now. What you're doing is creating the future with these words.
Yeah.
Do you want the same future?
Yeah.
You know, they say, well, you've got to look reality in the face. And actually, no, you haven't. No. Reality is where I'm sitting in my office now on Zoom talking to you. But my reality tomorrow will be the reality that was created by my words and acts and detail and everything I've done up until now and including today. So you are creating your own reality. A lot of people don't like that. And it isn't a fluffy new age positive thing. It's very clear. Let's go back to the religion I started with a little help from a guy called Jesus, who said, ask believing and you will receive. And the word for ask is actually more like command. You know, I state,
yeah.
You believe in that state and you will receive that state, good or bad.
Mm.
And one of the things, again, back to dear old Caroline, God bless us, God bless her, and she says about woundology is if people keep talking about the wound, then they are perpetrating it. So, yes, you have to shut up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I've had this for many, many years as I was breaking the codependent patterns with my mother. And that spell, and I was under that spell for many, many years when I coerced with that spell, but she was under a spell, which is why she imposed the spell on me.
Yeah.
And I had to stop talking about my mother to my friends all the time. Just shut up. Yeah. And then Pat starts saying, she's my greatest spiritual teacher, which is actually true. Because without all that and all the pain and the grief that she went through that was projected around, I wouldn't have come through to who I am now. So I need to be really, really grateful.
Yeah. Yeah. I think to me, the statement is not we create our own reality, but we co-create our own reality.
Good
with
point.
Spirit.
Yeah.
We're not masters of the universe, but.
No, we're not. But we are instructing spirit with our words.
Really? You think we're the boss of spirit?
No, we're not the boss of spirit, but we're saying, instead of saying, what is mine to do, you're saying, mine is to hurt.
Explain.
Okay. Oh, how do I do it without a tree of life diagram? Right. There's the tree of life in Judaic mysticism has four levels, physical, psychological, spiritual, divine.
Mm-hmm.
And what we would call the gonadic chakra in the human being is also the voice of spirit from your body.
Gonadic as in gonads?
Yes, as in sacral chakra, I think, you know, the one around your bits. You know,
right, yes.
The bits, perineum and all that.
You know? Yeah.
So your body speaks to you through your gut instinct.
Mm-hmm.
And your third eye and throat chakras are your voice and what you see. And they are the gonads of your spiritual soul group.
Mm-hmm.
So what you choose to look at and what you speak of actually go through to the collective and affect it.
Mm-hmm.
You're not actually saying, okay, God, I want to win the lottery. I wish for many, just, well, no, I don't want to win. I don't know. I do want to win the lottery. That's a whole new conversation. But no, I think when you keep repeatedly instruct spirit that you are ill, spirit, well, it's not so that spirit obeys you. Spirit says, could you wake up from that? Because you're making it.
Mm.
It's still a weave.
Yeah.
So, yes, I would totally agree with you that you co-create with spirit, but I also think that spirit will allow you to create either good or bad
totally.
Because you have free will.
Yeah. But I also think it's really important to state that it's not as simple as perhaps you're making it sound, simply because of all that spelling that we've been speaking about. And so that in that weave of what we are able to create is that which we've received from our ancestors, and that which we've received from our circumstances, and that which we've received from our, that inner thread that is truly us, and then all the ways in which that thread has been told to be other than what it authentically is. And that I know that there are, you know, there are plenty of people out there who'll be going, yes, Maggie, you're exactly right. We're creating our own reality with all the things we say and think and do. And others out there going, you total baggage, how dare you, because my life is, you know, this, yes, that, or the next thing, and I didn't make that.
Yes.
And I think it's really important to point out that it's far more complicated than simply our will. And yet, actually, at its core, it isn't. But
it's yes and.
It's yes and, yes. And that there's so much work to do for ourselves, in ourselves, around what did I inherit, what did I inherit,
yes,
and therefore what is inherent,
yes,
and what work do my ancestors need to free me from whatever it is that I am receiving down the ancestral lines. There's a statement, and I, as usual, can't remember where I heard it or which culture it belongs to, but that you know, we will never be whole, hale, hearty until we have healed our ancestors. And I think that's true.
That sounds like Stephen Jenkinson to me.
Does it? Okay.
Yes. Yeah. We mentioned him the other day, yeah, orphanwisdom.com, amazing man.
Yeah.
He doesn't take prisoners either.
Indeed.
No, you are absolutely right. There's no way you can tell somebody with fibromyalgia that if they think positive, they're going to get well.
No.
Because it's not like that. But it will start to help.
Mm.
It will start to ease the very belief that it might be possible that you can get well. And we have to do this in grading, because the way we're wired, the neural pathways in our brains, you can't go from depression to joy and stay in joy.
No.
You have to go from depression to rage to anger to maybe discouragement to then maybe hope. And then from then on, do you see what I mean? You have mm-hmm. to do it in stages, not to shock yourself for a start.
Mm.
And there's so much that if you have to make a U-turn with health, there's so much to be done. People often say to me, well, what was your secret in recovering from cancer? And I can't tell you, because it was a 3-year journey, and every step on that path was the next step.
Yeah.
And every step could have taken me in the right direction or the wrong direction, whatever the right direction or the wrong direction was. And an awful lot of it was about surrendering.
Yeah.
And an awful lot of it. But was saying, well, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. I can tell you what I did, and I can tell you about my experience. And I've actually got a lady who's in touch with me at the moment who's quite sick, but hopefully will make a full recovery. She certainly will in one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep saying to her, I'm not sure if there's anything I can say that helps. And she says, it just helps to talk to somebody who's been through it.
Yeah.
And who did come out the other side. And you just think, okay, thank you. I'll be there.
Yeah. And I think intention, the clarity of intention is everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that I suspect there is no right way. There's your right way and my right way, and everyone's individual and yet utterly the same right way.
Yeah.
But that if we have a really, really clear intention, it will carry us to and through that right way, the one that's, you know, good for us.
Yeah.
And that one of the things that I experienced to be true when I had cancer was I read somewhere in some bizarre corner of a healing manual that I found a few pages of in some recycling. It was really bizarre. I think it was something that maybe Fergus had had years ago. Anyway, I got it out to write a shopping list, and on the back, there's, I don't even know who wrote the manual, there's this statement that basically said that that cancer is the kind of curse, the thing that is the kind of equivalent of Adava Kavada or whatever it is in Harry Potter, in our culture is to be told you've got cancer.
Yes.
And that that anyone that does have it has on some level perhaps
had a death wish.
Yes.
And I saw in me that that was true. I think we've actually spoken about this before.
I think it's very rich territory and more speaking is good.
Yeah. But that I saw that it was true.
Yeah.
And that what that ignited in me was that, oh my goodness, you know, I don't need to die to get a rest. I just need to get a freaking backbone.
Yes!
And be able to claim my rest.
Yes!
And to be able to claim my Sabbath. I mean, here we are, back to what we were talking about last time.
And, you know, almost exactly the same thing happened to me because I was researching something to do with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, follicular non-Hodgkin's, blah, 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 on the internet. And I came across a site and I looked at it and it had a PDF in it, which was all about the death wish. Mm. It was in cancer. And I thought, oh. And that website's been taken down since then. I never found it again. Fortunately, I copied and pasted it and printed it off for myself.
Wow, excellent.
So it's almost the same story. And that was the lesson that was coming through for both of us, which is there is somewhere a death wish.
Yeah.
And it's not so much I want to die. It's just this is too much.
Yeah.
I can't take any more of this. And if you put, I was at a conference in Toledo many, many years ago talking about Kabbalah and the Divine Feminine, which was, there were a lot of men sitting there going, blah, blah, blah. and I actually cried during the talk and they were all going, blah, blah, blah. I did that. But at the end of it, three of them went, wow, and several others. So it worked out okay. But the point of this was...
Lost somewhere in the music.
Anyway, I must stop going off in different directions. What was it you were saying about the death wish?
Yes.
The death wish.
But that in itself is a tangent totally from something else I was saying, which I have no idea what it was.
Yes. No, I've lost my train of thought. But I'll go on another train of thought from the same conference, which is quite useful, I think. I was talking about the shape of the Tree of Life, and the two side triads, which are the emotions, our personal emotions, our wounds and our addictions, represent the waist. And
as
half
in the bit that's meant to be thinner in the middle of a human, or the
And I just had this complete revelation just before I was doing the talk and during the talk about corsets. You know, and I'm sorry that's going off in a completely different direction, but this idea that women were corseted to deny emotions.
Fascinating.
I don't know if that's so, but everybody I know in the spiritual world tends to wear looser clothing.
Totally. Oh, I find that really interesting, just because there's a...
I just want to say there's nothing wrong with wearing a corset when you want to be sexy.
Yeah?
If you want to wear it. If you feel sexy. And yes, I have. And moving on. But as an imposition to make your waist smaller, which basically means don't feel your emotions.
Yeah, well, don't feel much, frankly, because you can't breathe properly. But yes, like you said, if it floats your boat, fine, do it. But don't pull it so tight that you can't breathe. All that thing around the strictures of women's clothing I find fascinating, just because if you look at the history of the size, not so much the shape, but the size that a woman is allowed to be over the last century, the more of a voice we have, the less space we're allowed to take up. It's so interesting.
And yet you also see girls and women who put on a lot of weight
as
a defence.
Yeah.
And a very, don't come too close to me, I'm too vulnerable.
It's fascinating. Anyway, I believe that we've somehow managed to completely ramble off.
We were talking about words, weren't we?
Yes, okay, well done. Oh my goodness. Yes, both of us. I hope very much, dear listener, that it's not incredibly frustrating to listen to us, because we do both have this habit of going off at a tangent and quite possibly never returning to the original destination.
I'm actually making notes of things I wanted to come back to, but I haven't come back to them yet.
Okay.
Well, we were talking about words and I enthrallment and things, words that we misuse, like awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Or is not just somebody doing a great podcast.
No.
Or is standing in true thrall to the universe. You know, just, wow, this spell is amazing and it's good and it's wonderful. Wow. And the one that when I worked in a hospice I picked up, and Stephen Jenkinson has a lot to say on this, is palliative care.
Mm-hmm.
Because a pall covers things up. A pall is what's put over the coffin to hide the fact that it's a coffin.
Oh, my goodness.
And on the one hand, it's always yes and. On the one hand, yes, pain relief, absolutely.
Yeah.
But when I worked in the hospice, I saw people drugged out of understanding their death.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we both survived life-threatening illnesses, and we... Hopefully, when we do get to die, hopefully we will die wise. Hopefully we will embrace the death and go into it. And it is actually certainly getting to the point when quite a lot of people on the other side would like to meet again. But hopefully not for a while yet. In the movie Gladiator, you will meet again, but not yet. But to cover something with a pall, to hide death.
Mm.
And we were talking the other day about how when we're afraid of death, we won't live.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Any more words?
What, that are amazing spells?
Mm.
I think, to be truthful, I think every word is an amazing spell.
Yeah.
And that just because we're good at recommending books and people and CDs and not CDs, you know, those visual things. Videos. Technological witchy Crockford here knows all the words.
Oh, don't worry, we still say dial the telephone, don't we? You actually have got a telephone dial. I remember seeing it in your kitchen, which is amazing.
Oh, funny. One of my funniest moments ever was watching one of my son's friends approach our telephone, which has got the old-fashioned sticky finger in the circle thing, and move it round. They wanted to use our phone and they couldn't figure out how.
Does it still have letters on it as well as numbers?
Yep.
So when we lived in Harmon, it could be HAR321. Yes.
Yeah. So funny. Anyway, so back to
spells.
The spells of words is that, in my humble opinion, one of the most exquisite, potent, necessary and wise books ever written is called The Spell of the Sensuous by a man called David Abram. And in it, he examines this very notion from its inception as, when did we begin writing? And what have we done with writing, and how writing and the alphabet and the separation of the kind of sounds with which we communicate meaning into written symbols and then into, you know, books that hold knowledge and da-da-da, is the story in many ways of our separation from matter, from mata. And that... He really examines that thing of words are spells in minute detail, in a way that somebody, therefore, who you know, words really float my boat, despite my incredible inarticulate blathering on this website. I love words and I find them powerful and fascinating. And if you love words and find them powerful and fascinating, you will be absolutely enthralled, there's that word again, by this book. And if words are of some interest to you only, then he actually recommends that you kind of skip this whole chunk in the middle where he talks about the alphabet and, you know, the Greek and the Judaic and the diddly-da. And you then simply are invited into the realm of experiencing the sensual world. Hence the spell of the sensuous. It's truly one of the best books I've ever read. And
the
I
link
can't
will be
recommend
in the
it highly enough. Thank you. But yeah, you know, that one of the things that interests me hugely about words, and maybe one of the reasons I'm so into words, is that I come from a family of, you know, lucky me, very, very long-lived women. And so I knew very well both my grandmothers and my great-grandmother. And so I spent up until my early 20s in the presence of a woman who was born way over 100 years ago, way over 100 years ago. She was 99 when she died. And
my mum had me pretty young, but my granny and my great granny both didn't have their first child until I think they were 30. So they were, you know, they were older mothers, and therefore, as a grandparent and a great grandparent, they were old. And so they spoke the language of completely different generations. And to see how that language epitomizes the flavor of the era was fascinating. And then to see how particular words, you know, we're still using the same word, but for example, you know, a word that you use and bring up a lot, gay.
Mm.
To my grandmother,
oh, of course,
it was happy.
Yes.
To my mother,
to me as a child, it was happy. Yeah.
Okay, really. Mm. So to me, to my mother, it was a word which I don't think was derogatory for somebody who was homosexual. To my children, it's just something that's shit. And that's no reflection on homosexuality or on the deliciousness of something being jolly and gay. It was just an appropriation of a word, and it just means something completely different now. And who knows whether that will, you know, is that going to make it to the Oxford Dictionary of 2030 or whatever? What will gay mean? But words evolve massively.
They do, and the spells that come with them evolve as well.
Yeah, yes. And, you know, who knows whether it meaning shit, when actually congruently in our society, it does also mean homosexual and happy. Maybe that in itself is a spell.
Yes.
And so maybe out of respect for homosexuality, people should not be using that word. I really don't know. But
I know. I have this with people of colour sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I say the wrong word and I get it wrong. I I was working for Unity Online Radio before I decided I'd rather talk to you.
Thanks.
I was talking to a lady who of African American origin. See, I'm being cautious now because I'm scared of getting it wrong because of my generation having got it wrong. We were allowed to say black people or brown people or something. And of course, now you've got to be very, very careful. And she said that calling people of different colour, people of colour, was also pejorative. And I thought, if I pronounce that right, I may not even pronounce that right. And I was going,
pejorative.
Oh, pejorative, thank you. And I was thinking, oh my God, I didn't know.
Yeah.
I really didn't know. And it can be a real minefield. But we have to keep going and saying, I'm sorry, I didn't know.
Which, yeah.
And hopefully that will be accepted.
What I find absolutely fascinating about this, and I really hope I don't, do anything by way of kind of, you know, it is not my intention to cause offence to anybody when I say this. But I find it really intriguing that it is, that we are typically experience ourselves as being on really thin ice when we talk about those things. And what intrigues me is, why do we find it necessary to talk about those things at all? When someone is your friend, you don't give a rat's ass whether they like girls or boys or neither or both, and whether, you know, what colour they are. They could be purple with pink spots and you would still love them.
Yes.
And why does it matter? Why do we choose those things, firstly, to talk about? They're no one's business.
Yes.
And then to get our knickers in a knot about. And the fact that as a society we can create a situation where to name someone's appearance or someone's preferences can be an insult worthy of an international incident is absolutely extraordinary.
We are very good at taking offence. There's not usually that much intent to cause offence.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Well, all right, fair enough. But I'm talking, all right. I'll grant you that. But we are horribly prone to taking offence.
Yeah.
Okay. When somebody was meaning well and just got it wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think that comes from all the times when somebody didn't mean well.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a yes and.
It is, you know, the more I, as usual, I am speaking and trying these things out on my tongue, not as usual, but it seems like it's the way with talking to you, Maggie, I guess because you lead me into places that I don't necessarily normally go. But that it is experience of prejudice and persecution that makes those things the sore spot.
Yes, absolutely. And I want to say I'm really grateful that you do this and you do challenge me, because I was raised in a white middle class family and I've got spells. I'm not entirely clear. You know, you're absolutely right. I've got a friend called Yasmin who's of Indian and Australian parentage and is the most beautiful coffee colour. And Yasmin was just Yasmin.
Mm.
And one day I said to her, let's go down the road, the packy shop's still open. And she went, "Wah!" Quite obviously. But to me, it was just meant the corner shop run by brown people, because they were the only ones who worked hard enough to run the corner shop. But I know it was offensive, and I learned from it. I mean, I'm sorry to have said it here, but it's, you're absolutely right, if we can learn together. But I think we white folk do have to try harder.
Oh, too right.
Yeah. Really, really have to try harder and call stuff out.
Yeah.
When people say that somebody is wrong because they're slightly different from me.
Yeah. And to see how, you know, that, oh my goodness, you know, this is such a massive subject. There's one of the ways in which the spell of our culture is so pervasive that we as a culture of, you know, just in what we call the, you know, the acquisitive, the consumerist, the Western culture, typically it is dominated by the broken patriarchy, the whatever the broken word is for utterly white dominated, and that those two things are so insidiously interwoven into the very foundations of everything we believe to be true that we can't even see it.
Exactly. When you're in the world, you can't see what's wrong with it because it's serving you in some way.
Yeah.
Oh, God, yes, absolutely. Richard Rohr, he's the one to talk to about that. He did a wonderful podcast called Spiral of Violence about the three levels of evil in the world, which we can come back to another time because we're going to be running out of time on this one. But about you can't see the evil if it's in your psyche and you live in it and it benefits you.
Yeah, which just brings me back to that. Again, I'm so sorry that I can never remember who said these things.
You almost probably need to stop saying that. She says, ducking. Yes. Fortunately, we're not in the same room, so you can't hit me.
I would not offer you any violence, Maggie. Yes, maybe my memory would be better if I stopped apologising for the lack of it. That amazing phrase, which it's made by somebody terribly famous, all it takes for evil to thrive is for good men to do nothing.
Yes.
And that we, in order to change the society in which we live, which is so full of prejudice, basically, and hidden, invisible prejudice, is to very, very, very deliberately look for it, see it, undo it, unpick it, call it.
Yes.
But we have to make a really deliberate effort to do that, because if we're not making a deliberate effort, then it's going to be completely invisible to us, because we are raised within it. It's the air we breathe and the ground we stand on until we go, okay, where are you?
Yeah. And I'm going to add an adjunct onto that, because that phrase can also be used for passive aggression.
Which phrase?
For evil to succeed, it just requires good people to do nothing. Which is, as in, you're doing nothing and I'm out here doing this. I've seen it used that way on social media.
Oh, gosh, okay.
So I always add to it, you can always do something because you can always pray and bless.
Yeah.
And that is not doing nothing.
No. Well, and also we can always all work on ourselves.
Yes.
That's not doing nothing either.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because the only thing we can actually change is us.
Yeah.
And as we change, the people around us either adapt or move away.
Yeah. Which isn't to say that standing up and, you know, sitting in front of Parliament or all those other amazing activist things are not worthwhile, but they also come from the fund of the change within us.
Yes.
And, you know.
And again, the righteous anger must be at the situation and the force for change rather than hating and wishing to hurt the other who is wrong, in your view.
Yes. Nicely woven into exactly what we were talking about last time.
And I think we're kind of done. Would you like to say a nice, a nice thank you?
So yes, thank you for listening. And I hope we have made some sense, because my sense is that we've started off on a lot of things where we ended up somewhere else entirely.
But that's a conversation.
It is a conversation, yes.
I mean, if we could be doing it over your kitchen table or my kitchen table, it'll probably get even crazier.
Quite likely. Remembering, I'm just grateful, actually, that you can't come around and see what's in the bath this time. It's not cake.
Oh, I have to.
There's a deer hide in the bath, and literally, as I put it in there last night, I thought, so glad Maggie can't come and see this.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you next week.
Bye.